Hello, this is international football commentator Derek Ray, and you're listening to the Ranks FC podcast.
Hello Rank Squad and welcome to Ranks FC. It's your favourite transatlantic football podcast. We are right in the thick of the first of these transfer windows. But today we're also going to be talking about some new managerial appointments. There's been movers and shakers all over Europe. We're going to dive deep into a few of them in today's episode. My name is Jack Collins and I'll be your host today. And joining me across the water all the way from San Diego is Mr. Dean Jones. How you doing, mate?
Yeah, I'm good, mate. Yeah, the transfer window's just shut, so that was nice and short. Obviously, we've got another one coming up, but it's livened things up, hasn't it? Like, at least we've seen some, like, significant transfer activity early on in the summer, which you usually get one or two, but nothing like this. And obviously, with the Club World Cup happening and putting so much cash on the line, teams have been more willing to kind of go into the market. But even teams that aren't in the competition have been getting a bit active too, which has been interesting. It's just made the beginning of the summer more lively. And I think it's fun. Like, am I massively excited about the Club World Cup? No. But at least there is a couple of more areas of intrigue now in terms of actually watching it, because some of these teams have made significant signings that they are going to include. And also with the prize money, teams are going to take it seriously. So I think that that's a reason to now actually watch it. I'll be honest, I wasn't convinced I'd really watch much of it, but the closer it gets, I think I'll probably watch quite a lot of it, especially as I'm on the time zone in a better way than a lot of people are.
I was going to say, if anyone's going to watch it, surely the people on the West Coast are the best place to do so. Like, it's going to be on at all hours in the morning for me, which normally isn't a problem, but I've actually been trying to go to bed early because I'm getting married in a couple of weeks. So I've been trying to be good. Mm. This is not ideal for a Club World Cup starting this time.
No, you're going to kind of be in the position that I usually am, where I'm deciding which games are worth watching at the time and which games are worth watching after the event, and either trying to avoid the score or just knowing the outcome as you're watching the extended highlights or whatever. But I don't think that's the end of the world. Like, I think watching extended highlights of the Club World Cup without knowing the score is probably a good way actually to watch it if that's the situation that you find yourself in. I think that that's perfectly fine.
I think there's some really interesting things here. And look, some of them relate to managers we're going to talk about in parts two and three of the show. But like the fact that we get to see Xabi Alonso's Real Madrid for the first time and what that actually looks like as a shape, etc. We get to see Kivu's Inter and what it looks like in differentiation to, you know, Inzaghi's Inter. That they're the kind of things that intrigue me about this. We spoke on The Truth a couple of weeks ago about the Club World Cup, and I kind of said there were certain games that intrigued me, mostly seeing the kind of Argentine giants come up against some of their European counterparts and seeing what those games look like, seeing what the fans in the stands are like. All of those things I think I'm pretty intrigued by. There's a few teams here that I think someone is going to emerge as like a neutral's favourite that people weren't expecting. You know, LFC have kind of squeezed in last minute and actually have found themselves in a place where they might look at that group and think that's one we might be able to qualify from. Seattle Sounders, on the other hand, having a very, very difficult time of it. But I do think that someone is going to emerge and there will be a couple of players that emerge here, but there are trends to be learned and things to be gleaned off the Club World Cup. And I'm excited to see exactly what those things are before it begins.
Yeah, obviously the atmosphere at the games is going to be swayed as well by some of these teams actually have legit support that's reasonably close, and their actual normal supporters will be going to the games. A lot of the teams will just be followed by either neutrals or fans that are seeing their team perhaps live for the first time. So you're not going to get a wild atmosphere in that sense. It'll probably be a little bit like when we see friendlies played or like summer tournaments played in the US. That's the sort of atmosphere we'll get for a lot of them. Still
that
looks
said,
like
I was at that Atleti Real Madrid 8-2 in Jersey all those years back, and there were legitimate fights in the stands happening around Sam and I, which was not what I was expecting at MetLife that day.
Yeah, that's fair. We'll see how much passion there is. I mean, at the moment they're still struggling to get rid of the tickets, so it's still a problem. They're still you know, they can say, "Oh, out a new batch of tickets out now," and it's like, "Well, why don't you just make this? Why don't you make this accessible in the first place?" I looked the other day at like there's a game between Atleti and PSG happening in LA, and I was like, I wonder like how reasonably priced it is now. Like maybe we could go as a family and just go and watch that game. Like now PSG are the European champions. Like Dylan legitimately watches PSG now. Even Reese knows a couple of the PSG players because he started playing FIFA with Dylan. That might be fun, but it was $100 a ticket. And it's just like, I'm not going to do that. Like, and loads of people are going to be in that exact same boat. They're just not willing to pay that or able.
It's another one of those missed opportunities that I think we'll look back at. But we shall see. We shall see what
definitely
it looks like.
One thing to talk about, like in terms of the players that are there, one that I'm excited about, Jack, is Franco Mastantuono, who is joining Real Madrid, but still plays for River Plate right now. And so for the Club World Cup, he's going to be there. Now, this is a new star boy, right? And I've been writing about this lad for probably a year in terms of transfer potential. Man United were really looking at him at one point. I think Chelsea too. It's no big surprise that he's ended up going to Real Madrid and that's who he's going to be signing for. But he won't be joining Real Madrid until after this tournament is done. So Mastantuono is going to be a River Plate player. And they have a reasonably high profile game against the European side because they do play against Inter Milan. So that's one that I really like. Obviously, in the last couple of days, we've seen a bit of scrambling from clubs, particularly the likes of Chelsea, to try and sign people. You know, struggling with like Mike Maignan and Jamie Gittins. So some clubs didn't really get what they wanted. And then you had the likes of Manchester City, who do manage to get Rayan Cherki over the line and Tijani Reinders over the line. So it'll be interesting to see how they do. Obviously, Madrid have got their own new signings in tow too, as well as a new manager. So there are actually some really good storylines here. I don't like that this tournament is necessarily happening because everyone's exhausted already. And we've then got them going straight into another season a few weeks later because this is a month-long tournament. And so I definitely have concerns about like the effect that this is having on people. But if we're going to take it as pure entertainment, which is how I try to look at football, because I can't change the morals of the game. I can't change the finances of the game. All those things as somebody else's... under somebody else's bracket and in a different pay grade to me in the world. But let's just try and enjoy this. So I'm like, okay, let's go. Let's see what this tournament can throw up and let's see if we can embrace it. I didn't think we'd really be talking about this much on Patreon, but I think I actually will. I think I will. Like, for those that don't know, I'm already doing like pretty much a daily transfer push for transfers from Paradise over on Patreon, and we're getting a load of feedback on that. So please do come over if you fancy more podcasts, more newsletters, more chat with all of the Rank Squad and myself, and you obviously jumping in and around your wedding to discuss what you're being able to see. But I do think actually there will be some dispatches on what we're seeing at the Club World Cup, and particularly I want to get people involved in the Club World Cup because I don't think it's particularly going to be our opinions that matter as much on this tournament. I really want to hear from the Rank Squad over on Patreon over the course of this summer. And there'll be a lot of hot takes. We'll do Q&As and stuff like that. But with the new transfers that have just happened, with this new format of tournament, with so much financial stakes, I think it does just about now become interesting. And so I'm gonna try my best to get hyped for Al Ahly against Inter Miami on Saturday, June 14, and take it from there.
Yeah, Dean's going to have a sore back at the end of this summer for carrying the podcast through the end of June and the start of July. But I will be in and around it as well, doing as much as I can over.
Yeah, as long as you're around to upload the stuff, mate, then everyone will be all right, I think. It's the problem comes is if I'll let you off on the wedding day. I don't think you should be walking down the aisle worrying about whether transfers from Paradise has just dropped.
You might have to do newsletters for those couple of days, but we'll see how we go. But there's going to be loads of content. Link in the description as ever if you'd like to come and join us. We'd love to have you over there. Dean, is there anything from the world of transfers before we move on to these managerial appointments that's taken your eye in the last couple of days that you want to have a quick chat about?
I mean, I don't think that there's anything that's like really thrown me. I think that all of the ones that we talked about last week have pretty much gone through now. Bellingham and Cherki are the ones that we were talking about, and Delap obviously and stuff. So there was a lot of expectation for what would happen in this small window. And we've seen a lot of that come through. So I think that that's been good. I think that more the case of the leftovers now, I'm kind of already looking ahead to what was left over here. Like Ekitike is a leftover from this little transfer window. Victor Osimhen, a hangover, leftover from this transfer window. Those are the types of players that now I'm like, ooh, okay. That's where we get going again when things pick up, because I think there's still potential for both of those players to end up in the Premier League. I know that like Osimhen's played down massively, but the fact he didn't end up going to Saudi Arabia just makes me wonder. I've spoken to people recently and they're like, don't rule it out. Don't rule it out, because yeah, he seems like ungettable in terms of wages, but he might just, if a Liverpool or somebody comes like that was to come in, he might reconsider. And there are, you know, the fact that Chelsea, Man United, Arsenal, Liverpool, maybe Newcastle are all in the market for a striker just brings about this like, ooh, what if? Where does Ekitike land? Where does Osimhen land? Like, so that's kind of what is intriguing me at the moment.
Gyökeres too, right?
Gyökeres too, yeah. I mean, I still think that Man United is the prime spot for him. I've been reporting that Man United very much have him in sight. It's going to be difficult, but I keep being told, look, it's not impossible, because this is so important that United get a tried and tested nine in for Amorim, because he's insisting on it. And, you know, even I know there's been a report saying that Gyökeres is annoyed that Sporting seem to be going back on the fee that they were going to allow him out for. But to be honest, like, he's still going to be cheaper than like an Ekitike or something like that. So it's cheaper than a Sesko. So I still think he's going to hold reasonable value when you consider how many goals the bloke's actually been scoring on a weekly basis. So I think that that holds potential too. So yeah, more than what's just happened, because I think a lot of it was like predicted. I'm intrigued, like, Jack Grealish, where's he going to land? These sorts of things.
Yeah, 100%. I think it's going to be very interesting once this reopens in, what is it, 25 seconds a week? You know, whatever we're at now. It feels mad that there was just like, this is stopping. Why are we at a point where we're like, well, I'm just letting it run through? And I'm sure it's to deal with the Club World Cup and squads not being affected by transfers midway through it. But once you've opened the window, closing it and then opening it again feels really, really nuts. So we shall see. We shall see how that one pans out. Right, we're going to take a little break there. When we come back, we're turning our focus to some of the latest managerial appointments. Stick with us here on Ranks FC. Welcome back to Ranks FC, where we're talking managerial appointments, and the latest of which seems to be that Thomas Frank is going to be the new Tottenham Hotspur manager. Everything but the official confirmation as we're recording this podcast. And Dean, when Ange Postecoglou was kind of relieved of his duties, when they made that decision in terms of where he was and that he was going to move on, it felt like Spurs had kind of three targets in mind: Fulham's Marco Silva, Brentford's Thomas Frank, and Crystal Palace's Oliver Glasner. Now, Palace were pretty adamant that they weren't letting Glasner go anywhere. And after winning the FA Cup, I think that's pretty reasonable to look at holding him. But Frank has emerged as very much the target that they wanted, their first choice target in that regard. What gave him the kind of clinching edge in this?
I think a lot of it was to do with Johan Lange, who's the technical director. He was a preferred choice of his, and he had such a big say in who would be coming in. So I think that Lange definitely was pushing for him and was in his corner. So I think that that gave him an edge over somebody like Marco Silva, who didn't necessarily have somebody pushing him quite as hard. What we've got to look at with Tottenham is the kind of situation they are left with. They've got a really young team left over. And so they want somebody that can definitely develop the potential of those players, but also improve the star players that they've already got and the players who are on the verge of becoming star players to take them to the final stage. And then also do what Ange couldn't do, which was blend their defensive strengths with the fluid attacking play that Ange loved doing. Like, look, we were like purring over watching his Tottenham team and the way that they could explode and the way they could score goals, but obviously they couldn't keep it out the other end. So they wanted someone that could kind of blend those two things together. And Frank had always been on the cards. It was about 2 weeks ago that he started to become a very strong contender. There was one particular bookmaker who suddenly got a load of money through for Thomas Frank about 10 days, 2 weeks ago. And I spoke to someone about it. They were like, look, we've had some money in on Frank, and this isn't just like 20 quid. Like and usually in managerial markets, like, you don't get like a load of money coming in for someone like randomly. So like, just to tip you off, like, there probably is something in there. So that's when I looked into it, and that's when I started to really take Frank seriously as the lead contender. If you think about what he's done, take Mbeumo and Vissa, for example. If he's managed to lift them to the levels that they hit consistently at Brentford, what could he do, for example, with Brennan Johnson and Solanke? Like, let's use those two as an example. That's the kind of thing that we're looking at. What could he do with Archie Gray? How does he develop him? Now, one thing I find really interesting is Thomas Frank always leans on Norgaard, right? Always. In the Denmark youth teams, at Bromby, at Brentford, Norgaard was always there. Is Norgaard going to go to Tottenham? I don't think it's the worst idea in the world. I really don't. He's 31 now, and he only signed a new contract at Brentford a few months ago. Those two things I do see as a slight problem. But I also don't believe there is a chance that Thomas Frank has not thought, how am I going to get Norgaard in here? Because I need a DM. And he is my voice and my eyes and my brain on that pitch, because I don't know life without this guy. Like, they've talked before about having like a father-son relationship. And you always need trusted disciples within your setup. You always hear about managers wanting to have a player that completely understands what they're about in their team. So, I don't know if this is going to happen, but like, this is something that legitimately Frank has had throughout his entire career, is Norgaard at the middle of it. So Brentford definitely won't want to lose him as well. There's no way they want that to happen. But if it's not him, then who is it? Who is that guy that sits in the centre of the park? I don't know if Tottenham already have that player, if he's got to develop that player, or if he's got to buy that player. But there's some things there for him to think about. Obviously, there's players like Bergvall, who I think he can also take to another level. They're really excited about what he can give them. I don't think it's a guarantee of success. I don't know that Thomas Frank is in the top five managers in the Premier League. If I was to quickly draw up a ranking, I don't think I'd put him in that. But is in the tier below, and his ability now, the potential now, is to break into that and show what he can really do on this stage.
Yeah, I've been thinking about this ranking and thinking about what we were going to talk about in this podcast today. I'm kind of trying to pull up some pros and cons for everyone who's moved managerial roles and kind of see what we can kind of balance out in a discussion. And obviously, in terms of the Tottenham manager, who was going to be the next Tottenham manager, there's a personal interest in that. I was pretty delighted that Marco Silva would be staying at Fulham as opposed to anything else. But I was trying to work out why, because I actually think that whilst obviously the reputations are slightly different in terms of the global public, what Marco Silva and Thomas Frank have done at Fulham and Brentford respectively is not a million miles apart, right? Take over a club in the Championship, they take them to the Premier League, playing pretty good football, swashbuckling football, and then they adapt when they get to the Premier League. Now, they're not the same kind of manager and they have slightly different styles in terms of how they want to impose their game state. But I was trying to work out what the differences were in terms of why Spurs would have gone one way. And look, Johan Lange, as you say, is a big part of this. The other part is that I think that Thomas Frank has a much better record of developing young players.
Yeah.
And Marco Silva, we know, leans on players who are more experienced. He likes to kind of rehabilitate careers that have maybe not gone as players have planned. Whereas Thomas Frank has taken a few players from lower reaches, from less heralded leagues, etc., and turned them into genuine Premier League superstars. So I think you're right. And I think you're in the Norgard thing is interesting. I wonder if there is an element of this that you're looking at it and thinking, if you're Spurs, maybe we shouldn't have put an option to buy in that Pierre-Emile Højbjerg contract at Marseille. Would Thomas Frank have
honestly, I think that's one of his
former Denmark players and former youth players at Denmark kind of working under him at this point? Who knows? But I mean, it doesn't matter now because he's very much a Marseille and very happy there. But I think that one of the things here is that ability to improve players. And we've seen it in a different way. The thing that I think is going to be interesting for Spurs fans is they went from this kind of arch pragmatism of Mourinho and Conte, right? That defensive football, and they kind of hated the football and didn't give the results that they wanted in those periods, to the arch idealist in Ange Postecoglou, who shifted the kind of mood. And I kind of referred to this earlier on the radio as the kind of change in the Overton window, if you will. Mm. Obviously, that's a political term, but what they went from is this kind of from a really, really defensive football to this uber attacking, we want to impress but we want to impress a style of really exciting football that you want to watch on this team. And now I think Spurs fans are probably like, could do with a little bit more pragmatism. And I think that's probably where they land with Thomas Frank, right? They land on someone who has been able to play that kind of interesting swashbuckling football in the Championship, has moved to the Premier League and be like, right, if we do that, we're going to get relegated, so we can't play like that. They went to a far more pragmatic approach. That Brentford have squeezed the margins massively. And look, there are differing opinions on the way that Brentford play, but I think the one thing that everyone could agree on is they've squeezed the margins in terms of set pieces, in terms of, you know, working things out from kickoff, in terms of the way that they have played direct long ball at times in order to take advantage of situations. Frank is not afraid to basically be like, right, okay, if that isn't working, we go long and we try and win second balls. We saw it with Ivan Toney when he was there, and the way that Mbeumo played off Ivan Toney as basically kind of a long ball flick on player. And there was always the shouts of kind of like, are they playing like Stoke, the long throws, etc. Fine, whatever. But it worked. And I think that's the kind of main thing about this. So you get to this point and you're thinking, okay, what's it going to look like at Spurs? And the answer is, we don't know. Right. Mm. We heard Thomas Frank talking in conversation with Fabian Hertzler and saying to him, I'd love to play football like you play, but I need an extra 100 million in order to do it.
Right.
Well, now he's got it. Now he's got it. So is he going to play that way? I think Spurs fans can be pleased about the fact that they are probably not going to be quite as bad from set pieces this year, because we know that Frank has brought that wherever he's gone. He's a big kind of believer in the fact that if you get these opportunities, you need to take advantage of them. And I'm sure that that will be music to the ears of Spurs fans. But equally, it's not going to be as swashbuckling as Ange Postecoglou was, because there is just naturally a more pragmatic person in Thomas Frank. And kind of moving away from that, okay, we lost, but we lost the Spurs way. Think back to that game against Chelsea, right? With 9 men and playing that suicidally high line. But it was kind of like, we lost, but hey, man, we had fun. We had loads of fun. We were doing this and we stayed in it. And okay, maybe it was a little bit naive, but my God, was it entertaining? that's something you come away from. And look, it's not something that Ange Postecoglou used throughout the end of it, especially in the Europa League. And we didn't see some pretty dull games towards the end of that in terms of getting over the line. But I think as an appointment for me, this one makes sense. I think that if they were going to go somewhere in the Premier League, this is the move that I would have gone with if I was the Spurs hierarchy. And yeah, appreciated. I think that there's not much between Silva and Frank. But in terms of the squad that Spurs have put together, the youngsters that are coming in, it makes sense to lean towards a manager in that who is going to be more open and more soft on the idea of giving those young players minutes and bedding them in early on than one who likes to rely on their experienced heads. And that, I think, for me, is the big difference. So,
yeah, I mean, look, can he deliver a trophy? I don't know. I mean, like, this is the thing. I mean, he'll definitely make them better and more competitive in the league. And I mean,
Spurs will not be finishing 17th under Thomas Frank.
I mean, Brentford finished 18 points ahead of Tottenham last season, with a squad that was built on a much smaller budget, much less expectation. And so that's kind of what Tottenham are buying into here. They're buying into a guy that's been able to punch above his weight and now has the ability to have better resources, but more expectation to deliver. It'll be interesting because, you know, sacking Postecoglou isn't wrong. It's not the wrong decision, but what's an improvement on it? It has to, you've got to be at least competing to make the Champions League next season. And if you do miss out on making it into the Champions League in the league and you don't win a cup, then you're kind of like, well, what was the point? The football's got to have been extremely good and you've got to have some really big, good games throughout the season to make sure that this was worth it, because you're still paying like £10 million to get this bloke out of Brentford. So it's still a slight gamble. Like,
100%. It's definitely a gamble. Like, and you know, to come to kind of the flip side of it quickly, you're hiring a manager who hasn't got that Champions League experience to take you back into the Champions League.
True, yeah.
As opposed to Ange Postecoglou. You're getting rid of a manager who ended and changed the lives of Spurs fans for a decade now. There is no trophy chat. You've got nothing in there. You've got nothing in the cabinet, etc. That just goes away for a decade. So from an emotional perspective, look, I'm quick to criticize Daniel Levy, right? I have been in the past and I will be, I'm sure, again in the future. But I think he's a bit damned if he does, damned if he doesn't here. Because if they start the season, they keep Postecoglou, people will be like, did you not learn anything from what happened with Erik ten Hag and the FA Cup, right? And if they now switch managers and it doesn't go to plan, they're going to be like, why didn't we keep Postecoglou? He won us a trophy. Mm. So it has to go perfectly or you're in real trouble. But I do think that in terms of, there is an expectation jump. And I don't say that in terms of to talk down on other clubs in the Premier League, but you actually look at Brentford's record last season under Frank. They only won at home until like Christmas. They didn't win any away games. And then they went through a period where they couldn't win at home. They only won away. It was really strange in many, many different ways.
Yeah.
And you kind of come to that and you think, well, if you lose 5-6 games on the bounce at home, even if you've won the away games, are fans going to start getting restless? Oh, I think the answer is yes, right? Like, fans are going to begin getting restless, especially if you don't win the Champions League. And let's be honest, I'll be absolutely stunned if Spurs win the Champions League under any manager, right? There's nothing to do with Thomas Frank. They're just not going to win the Champions League next year. And I don't think any Spurs fan would expect that. But at least with this year, there was that feeling of like, could win the Europa League, you know, could win the Europa League. It kind of didn't distract all of the issues, but it definitely was kind of one of those things that was in the background thinking as it's kind of like a burning flame. Whereas that probably isn't going to be there. Maybe they go and win the Carabao Cup. Maybe they win the FA Cup. I don't know what that looks like. But I do think that that pressure jump and the lack of Champions League experience are the things that count against Thomas Frank here. And the idea that he's just not the man who's just won them a trophy. Aside from that, I don't really think there's any holes in the idea of appointing him. Every managerial appointment is a gamble to some degree, right? But I think in terms of what the things are that we know, the underlying numbers, etc., all of those things, they point to suggest that this is a sensible move and a manager who's on the up within their managerial trajectory.
Yeah. Interested on what you make of my plot twist, though. I think Brentford should be going for Postecoglou.
Yeah, well, I always said that if Spurs took Silva, then I would take Postecoglou at the cottage. So I think that there is a flip side of that.
I don't think it'll happen, but I really think there's worse ideas than being like, mate, come here. We'll finish above them. We'll finish above Tottenham. come and do it. We completely believe you. Top bloke. You're really fitting around here. Little club, family club. Got a stadium that looks like Legoland. You'll love it. Like, come in. Sorry, Brentford fans, had to have a dig.
You're never going to get away with it completely.
But
I don't think it's a particularly bad shout at all. I don't think Brentford will do that. I think that they're smarter than that. Or whether that's Justin Cochrane who sticks around and gets promoted from within, like Thomas Frank did, or whether they make.
He's going with Frank.
Well, I was going to say, this was my kind of final question on it, right? Because how much of this Brentford backroom staff is going to go with him?
All of them.
And I think that the question becomes. Thomas Frank at Brentford has lent on one of the smartest operations in the Premier League, right? He has lent on an absolutely unbelievable analytics department headed by a chairman who is not only a fan of the club, but who genuinely has had that kind of experience working in the world of betting odds and learning how to kind of beat the margins, etc. They lean on that. And it's a kind of an operation at the top of the club that is so well run. And that goes down from the very, very top on the board, all the way through to the data analysis team, all the way through the kind of scouting networks. Thomas Frank has lent on that. He's been propped up by it at times, right? And that doesn't mean that he hasn't been excellent in terms of what he's achieved tactically and on the field, but he hasn't had to be 360 across all of it. At Spurs, he's going into a very different operation where the opportunities to spend, et cetera, are controlled by different people who aren't necessarily all exactly pulling on the same page. There is a new CEO in here. We're talking about Daniel Levy at the top of the club. There's a lot of different elements coming in to kind of work in different things. It's not going to be as cohesive an operation as it was at Brentford.
Yeah, no, that's true. But he'll know that. He'll know that his success is dependent on having the right people around him. He's not going to go into that job without those figures around him. So that's, you know, as we sit here right now, those are the negotiations that are taking place. There's four of the guys that he's trying to take with him. And I'm sure that those four will end up going, even if they have to pay a bit more money in compensation for it to happen.
No, if you're Justin Cochrane, you're like, do you want a first team managerial job or do you want to follow this guy up the road to North London? I think I'd be like,
depends.
It's been good here, you know? It's been good here.
Some people like living in the shadows a bit more and like working in the dark. I know quite a lot of people that don't want that main job because the pressures are different and suddenly you lose your job after 3 months and you're out on the streets fending for yourself suddenly when you could have just been sat there next to your mate just shouting a few instructions, taking a few training drills. So some people just like the safety of going with the big guy.
Yeah, well, that bit too TBC, but we'll see how it all shakes out. Let's move on now and let's go to Real Madrid. We obviously mentioned them at the top of the episode in part one. Xabi Alonso took his first day of training today. Now, I've seen a bit of overreaction to this, I will say. Sure. There was a video of a drill and they were basically just doing some pressing stuff. There was about 100 comments being like, he's taking us right back to the top. I was like, lads, you do this at under 10 level. Like, you can't be like, this is the thing that changes everything for Real Madrid. But look, it speaks to a lack of kind of cohesion and that element of, we haven't seen much of this kind of thing. And look, that's potentially because there weren't cameras allowed in the same bits under Carlo and they're trying to kind of create a new image around it. But this is a huge job. Now, Xabi Alonso has bided his time. He has worked his way through, all the way through from the Real Madrid youth teams, then onto Real Sociedad, where he worked with the B teams, turned down big jobs in Germany. The Eintracht Frankfurt job was offered to him. He didn't take it. He waited for that Leverkusen job, did a wonderful job there, turning them around from a team that just leaked goals and were incredibly fun to watch to a team that went invincible over a domestic season and were one game away from having a fully invincible season. Obviously took a little bit of a regression step last year, but still finished second in the Bundesliga. And he goes to Real Madrid, now probably the biggest club in the world, if not the biggest, then in the top two. And this is a whole new level of pressure. But it feels like the right appointment at the right time for Real Madrid, Dean.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is a fun one. And I think it's in line too with, you see the signings that they're making in like Dean Howson and like that excites me. Like, how's Xavi Alonso going to build out the back from here? What's he doing with Trent, for example? Mastantuono, who I mentioned earlier, like how's he going to start integrating players like that? Rodrigo, we don't know if Rodrigo is staying or going at the moment, but I've seen Madrid accounts really paying close attention in those early training drills to the fact that Alonso is being very specific about what Rodrigo's doing in those attacking drills and holding some hope that maybe he's going to hang around after all because he sees a bit more light at the end of the tunnel and some starts coming his way, not just when there's injuries and suspensions. And then obviously the star factors of Mbappe's and Vinny's and Bellingham's and what he can unlock in those guys. But obviously when you're a former player, it's different. And the fact that he's not that far removed from this team means he talks to these players on a different level. And that's so different. Like Ancelotti, like obviously is like godfather of football, like the granddad, if you like, of the way that he would have spoken to the players. And if he even, you know, a lot of the time doesn't even speak to players sometimes, like he doesn't need to. Not in a way that someone like Xavi Alonso will probably put an arm around people, be a bit more like understanding of the world that they're growing up in. That's probably something that Ancelotti would struggle with, right? That makes sense given the age differences. And I know that that happened a lot. Roy Hodgson, for example, like he could never get into, couldn't understand the mindset of a 20-year-old footballer. So got other people to kind of deal with that while he just dealt with the other things to do with the team. And that's fine. Like when there's a 50-year age gap.
Yeah, like, it's not a problem necessarily.
It's not a problem. But with Xavi Alonso, that's now gone. And I think, yeah, for players like Housen, that's really exciting to have an icon that's memorable in your lifetime coming into the team and looking to reshape things. Obviously, there's more signings to come as well for Real Madrid. We're only seeing the very beginnings of it. But I think it's exciting. I think that the way that they play, we've already seen signs of what Xavi Alonso wants to do from his time in the Bundesliga. And like this will be a level up from that because he's got better players to work with and a different culture of football to now play around, which he understands better. That's the other thing. He understands the culture of Spanish football better. He had to adapt to what he was doing in Germany and he did it very quickly and very well. But I think it's brilliant for Real Madrid. I always kind of hoped that this was where Alonso would end up. Obviously, he could have ended up at Liverpool at one point. But yeah, I think that for any Madrid fans who are just kind of looking for a slight change of heart, and I know that like Ancelotti's strength sometimes is that he doesn't even know what they're going to be doing in terms of a game plan from 1 month to the next. You're going to know what your style of play is now. And the good news is it's going to be fun.
Yeah, I think there's no doubt about that. I mean, look, the question is, how do players respond to a manager who's probably going to demand more intensity, who's going to demand more of a kind of team ethic to Carlo's kind of slightly more standoffish approach, which worked for so many years, but kind of fell short a little bit last year. We spoke about the fact over the course of this season that we've seen PSG and Barcelona in particular kind of demand this kind of individualism within this team ethic, right? And we see the work rate of this PSG side that are now champions of Europe. And you're thinking, well, that's the new standard. Can you go and meet it? And it doesn't mean that everyone has to play in exactly the same way by any stretch of the imagination, but it does involve everybody working for the same goals, etc. And it felt like Real Madrid lacked a little bit of that last season. So what this is going to look like with Xabi Alonso, I think it's going to be distinctly different. Now, a lot of people have speculated over what the formation is going to be. Are Real Madrid going to suddenly move to this three at the back formation with Xabi Alonso there? There's been talk of Arda Güler dropping deeper in the absence of Luka Modric and start to learn how to control games from those elements. I don't know how much of this is going to come to pass.
I don't think they will do three at the back, like. Personally. I don't think they will play three at the back. I just spoke to someone the other day who's covering Madrid about Housen, and they were like, he's the starter and you're competing for the other spot alongside him. So the kind of expectation, I think, is that they don't go with three at the back from the start anyway.
Yeah, I mean, look, this is it. Well, you have to remember that Xabi Alonso didn't walk into Leverkusen and start playing three at the back, right? That was a response to the way that the team was set up and the fact that they were leaking goals, and it worked, obviously. And I think that he will come in there with a fresh slate and be like, okay, how do we get the best out of this group of players? And if it means that they have to revert to that at some point in the season to balance the defensive aspect of it, then so be it. But I imagine he's not going to go in with a predetermined theory of exactly how this team are going to play. He's going to work that out as he goes through this Club World Cup. And, you know, it takes it back to your point right at the beginning. I'm intrigued to see what Real Madrid look like, what this shape looks like, who's playing where when it comes to the Club World Cup, because that's the bit which gives you the first indications of exactly what it might look like. It might not look like this in February next year, but it probably will do in August. Yeah. So I think that that's the bit of this that's really exciting. But it didn't really feel like there were any other major candidates for this role at the point of Carlo's departure, right? It felt like they had one target in mind. There was no kind of question marks over whether that target would come at this point. It didn't ever feel like Leverkusen were going to stand in his way. And, you know, there's been plenty of talk about the fact that there were exit clauses that Xabi Alonso had in his contract for certain clubs that he has affiliations with in the past. Mm-hmm. So it didn't really feel like there was any choices or there was any decisions almost made in this one. It was like the natural progression path for everyone involved. And I think that that for me is the bit of this that is intriguing. What do Real Madrid do if this doesn't work out? Now, again, I'd be stunned if it doesn't work out, maybe not the first season and everything's perfect immediately, but it doesn't work out over the next couple of years. The questions are, I suppose, is he going to be given the time to imprint himself upon this squad and actually make sure that things are working in the way that he wants them to? Because this is perhaps the most high demanding club in world football. And we've seen that second isn't enough when you're talking about Real Madrid. And something that's happened this season, you know, we heard quotes from Carlo Ancelotti, who had won the double the year before in the Champions League and La Liga. In October, November, being like, I had a suitcase packed by the door ready to go because of what happened, you know, in the first 3-4 weeks of the Champions League. This is an unforgiving industry, especially when you're coming into a club of this size. It is an unforgiving press, in particular in Spain, and you have to get them on side pretty rapidly. Now, he might do that by winning the Club World Cup, but equally, I am intrigued just to see what happens if there is a little bit of a wobble with this, if there are some teething problems. And look, that's not to say there will be, and it's not to say that I want there to be. I just feel like it's going to be interesting to see what happens if things aren't perfect off the bat, if things don't immediately all work out in the same way. Is he going to be given the rope to be allowed to work things out and work out the kinks within this squad?
Yeah, absolutely that, yeah. Kinks of the squad. I mean, should be able to figure that out at Real Madrid.
You hope so, right?
there's harder jobs in football, I think, than figuring that out or having to worry about that even. So, yeah, I mean, more of a sure thing than Thomas Frank, that's for sure. I just feel that this is one that I'd be very comfortable with if this was my team.
Yeah, I don't want to use the whole, this is the banker, this is the one that could not fail, because famously, that doesn't always end well.
No.
And actually, talking of that, let's go to the man who's replacing Xabi Alonso at Leverkusen, which is Erik ten Hag, right? He is the man who's been tasked with following what has been a complete turnaround. And I think it's important to remember that, you know, whilst last season wasn't Leverkusen's finest hour, I think the crashing out in the DFB Pokal in particular was a pretty low point for Leverkusen after what they achieved the season before. Equally, it's not every year that Leverkusen finish in the top two of the Bundesliga. If that had happened the other way around, people would have been like, what a great building season. What an incredible step forward Leverkusen have made. And I think that, you know, sometimes once you've won something, it's easy to forget that that is not the norm. It's not normal for Leverkusen to go an unbeaten season domestically. It's not normal for them to be in the conversation for the league title. It hasn't been. You know, over the course of the last two decades, we haven't really seen Leverkusen in those conversations. And Xabi Alonso changed all that. So following that and following what looks like there might be a major exodus in terms of players around him, we've obviously seen Frimpong already leaving for Liverpool. It looks like Florian Wirtz is going to follow him to Anfield at this point, although not a done deal as we speak. But there's also this kind of element of like, how do you follow what has been an era? And I'll come back to this when we're talking about Inter in part three, but what goes on now and how Leverkusen deal with this is going to be very interesting. I'll be honest, this was not where I would have gone if I was Leverkusen. But I also don't think it's the worst decision in the world. I think that there is more in Erik ten Hag that can be unlocked. I think we've seen managers come out of Old Trafford, players come out of Old Trafford and find new leases of life elsewhere. Erik ten Hag is a good coach. And whilst he's had his reputation damaged a little bit by everything that happened at Old Trafford, he still won trophies there. He achieved more trophies in his tenure than most managers had done in the Premier League in that era. And I think that in that context, in the context of the struggles afterwards, there will have been people at Leverkusen who have gone, that was the wrong place at the wrong time. This might be a fit for his style of football. Equally, there's a massive rebuilding job on his hands here. And I think that that's going to be a difficult task as well, DJ.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously filling in Alonso's shoes is tough, but then also dealing with departures of Frimpong, Jonathan Tah, Wirtz, we assume. That's difficult. But again, at least it's a fresh start, and at least perhaps he gets a say in how they go about that. And so I don't think that's the end of the world, as long as because now he knows early that those players are gone/going. But the one thing that he's got here that he had at United is an instant pressure to deliver. It's not on the same level as Man United, obviously, on a global respect. You're not going to get the same backlash every time you lose a game as you do when you're at United, one of the biggest clubs in the world. So it's a better place for him to be. It's still going to be tough, but you've got to forget some of the stuff that happened at Man United. Remember the good stuff that had happened at Ajax. He can develop players. He can be good tactically. And more than anything, this is his shot at redemption. And that's perhaps a real factor that has to come in here for Leverkusen. Is like, this is a guy, I can't even imagine what he was like in his interviews, but I can presume that there was a huge determination and self-belief in him to be like, just give me this shot. I need to get back into the game. You guys have got a great platform. You're in a really difficult situation, but I am too. So we've all got to make the most of this moment. And so I can kind of see why they would take a chance on it. I think it's high stakes. I think that there's definitely risk attached to it. And I don't think that every player is going to want to go and sign for him, like maybe would have been the case with some other managers coming into Leverkusen and thinking, oh, that sounds exciting. Some will be like Jack Grealish might be like, Leverkusen, oh no, didn't Ten Hag just, nah, leave that. So I'm not sure what his pull is going to be anymore for certain types of players. But then there'll be other sorts of players that he's worked with through his career in the earlier years, and he's got some grounding in German football too, of understanding it, that will really trust him. So I don't think it's the worst idea. I kind of am rooting for him. I don't want to see him fail here. I think it would be quite fun if he had a great season. But it's a bit more in the Thomas Frank category than it is the Xabi Alonso category.
Yeah, I think there's plenty of risk associated with this. But I don't mind it as a shot of redemption. I got to say, I thought it was going to be very interesting what they did next, who was going to be that man. And I wonder if Ange Postecoglou was on the market earlier on, would they have maybe had a sniff around that? I always feel like Ange's football actually might be the one that suits the Bundesliga best. But equally, you know, that was something that wasn't on the market and they had to move decisively and swiftly. And that's exactly what they did. I mean, look, they brought in Ibrahim Matsa from Hertha, who is a very, very interesting player, had a really interesting time of it in the Zweite Bundesliga, 19 years old, attacking midfielder. You'd imagine that he's someone, maybe not immediately, but could potentially fill that Florian Wirtz role in the future. Mm-hmm. Now, he's not going to be as good as that. Let's not be silly. But equally, there is a level of you have to just, you know, try and fill these places. And there's going to be a lot of money to spend if that Wirtz transfer does go through. There's going to be a lot of money on the table for Bayer Leverkusen. They brought Mark Flecken in from Brentford, which seems like a safer pair of hands between the sticks. I mean, not the best goalkeeper in the world, but a good shot stopper at the same time. What this team looks like, do they switch formations, especially having lost Frimpong and that kind of right wing back role? Do we go to a four at the back here with Leverkusen? What's it all going to look like? I'm intrigued by so much of it. And I do think that it's going to be interesting. The other thing, and I think maybe the thing you missed out there, was that Erik ten Hag had a very, very good reputation for bringing through young players at Ajax, and actually gave opportunities as well at Manchester United for young players to come in and make a difference. If you're a young player at that point thinking, oh, hang on, this is a team that's in the Champions League next season, and this is a manager who has a track record of making sure that young players thrive and giving them the opportunities to start in teams and work their way into teams, that's something you will be looking at and thinking, well, that's a club that I might like to join. They have money now. They might be able to spend a little bit more on some of the brighter young talents. They have to be smart with how they spend it, of course. But I do think that it puts up some quite fertile soil they get this transfer window right. Sure. For Erik ten Hag to basically be like, look, bring me these kind of players and I will develop them, and we can make, you know, one, players grow into a team that we're proud of, and two, we might be able to make this into a profit-making exercise at the same time. Yeah. That's something that you always have to kind of bear in mind with the sell-to-buy elements of things in Germany. So I do quite like it, and I've got to say that whilst it wouldn't have been my first choice, I'm relatively pleased for Ten Hag that he's ended up somewhere where he probably can have a good go at kind of restoring his reputation, but also for Leverkusen that they have someone in there who is going to be working incredibly hard to keep them at the level that they're at right now, even in a summer of transition. Yeah. So I quite like it. Yeah, I quite like absolutely. It. Right. We're going to take a little break there. When we come back, we're going to be talking about the Italian managerial merry-go-round, the madness going on in Serie A. Stick with us.
Welcome back to Ranks FC, where, Jack, I'm kind of banking on you here to get me into the loop, because I feel like some of this stuff is going to have passed me by a little bit while I've been on transfer focus. So you're talking about managerial changes in Italy. What do we need to know?
Well, this was a madness, right? And it probably just needs a little bit of context, because 2 weeks ago, it looked like one of the top nine might keep their manager, because Antonio Conte was seemingly at odds with Aurelio De Laurentiis at Napoli. Juventus were making goo-goo eyes at him and being like, why don't you come back here? Then the news dropped that Simone Inzaghi might be considering leaving Inter after the Champions League final, something that has come to pass. Paladino signed a new contract at Fiorentina, and then walked out on them a month later. So that one happened. Gasperini decided he wasn't going to stick around at Atalanta. He's now gone to Roma. They've replaced him with Ivan Juric, who was sacked from two clubs last season and got Southampton relegated in last place in the Premier League. So that's an interesting one. We'll come on to that in a little while. Gasperini now at Roma. Maurizio Sarri is back in at Lazio. Juventus have decided that they're going to stick with Igor Tudor, which is something. And Napoli did keep Antonio Conte in the end. They worked out the rift, which was an important one for them. And Milan, who went through two managers last season, I've gone back to Max Allegri. Hey. So that's going to be fun as well. So all change. There is no word as of yet who is going to be stepping up for Fiorentina. There are links to Stefano Pioli, but he's also linked to the Italian national team job, who, just to really get in on the act, decided they were going to sack Luciano Spalletti a couple of days ago, which he announced at his own press conference before the game against Moldova, which they won. So Claudio Ranieri has turned down the Italian national team job. Everything is up in the air. Everything feels like it's on fire in Serie A. So let's try and make some sense of this. So there's a few new managerial appointments I think worth talking about. Talk about Christian Kivu, who's taken over from Inzaghi at Inter. Max Allegri at Milan on the other side of that one. Gasperini taking the Roma job is really interesting, I think, taking over from Claudio Ranieri, who's gone upstairs into an advisory role. And then Juric at Atalanta, which we'll finish with. So Let's start with Christian Kivu, who is an Inter legend. Equally, he's managed 13 games in Serie A in his entire life, and he's taking over from one of the most successful periods of Inter in this kind of modern era. Not ever, because Inter used to be a force majeure, shall we say, in European football, but this has still been really, really impressive over the last couple of years. In the last 4 years alone, Inzaghi has won two Serie A's, come close to two others. He has got to two Champions League finals and brought in a host of trophies, all while turning the club a profit. And considering where they were when he came in, where they were splashing cash on Lukaku and Barella and the likes of that, to suddenly become a kind of loss-making enterprise and having to work with free transfers, Marotta deserves a massive amount of credit for the team that he's been able to build, even on a shoestring budget. This has been a major, major job that Inzaghi has done. He has worked almost miracles with this squad. He has turned them into regular forces in European competition, but also in terms of bringing regular trophies back to Inter. It's been pretty much a masterclass. Now, he's bopped off to have unlimited money to spend at Al Hilal, which you can't really begrudge him after he's basically not been able to spend any money over the last couple of years at Inter working on free transfers. But it means that there's this huge gap. Now, Kivu has managed 13 senior games. He did a good job with Parma in a three-at-the-back formation, we should probably add, in terms of keeping them safe last season. He went in there and sorted things out, and there were some very impressive performances, not least against Napoli, where he thought he was doing Inter a favour, but they managed to cock it up on the same night against Lazio. Mm-hmm. But also it is worth bearing in mind that he has worked his way through the Inter system, working through the youth teams all the way up to the Primavera squad, where he won the Scudetto Primavera in 23-24, which was kind of the culmination of his work. And that's what he was appointed at Parma off the back of. So now he goes back to a club that he knows incredibly well, that he worked with the youth systems under Inzaghi, who would have been training them in a similar kind of way to try and make that bridge between the youth systems and the first team less daunting, shall we say. Mm-hmm. He is very much a club man, and the club is well within his heart. Now, not only is he part of the treble winning squad, but also someone who very much kind of owes all of his allegiance and his coaching badges and all of that to Inter. So from that perspective, in an era of transition, bringing someone in who knows the club so well and who isn't going to stylistically differentiate immediately, it's not to say he's not going to do that in the future, but immediately it looks like it's quite solid. Now, there's a lot of older players at Inter, and we talked about this with the Champions League final and that might be towards their kind of sunset of their career, shall we say. And that includes two of the midfield three in Calhanoglu and Mkhitaryan. Barella, well, there was talk of him potentially following Inzaghi to Al Hilal, which I think would be a bad thing for everyone involved. Mm-hmm. But also there's a few kind of players here, especially in the defensive line, who are maybe kind of coming towards the end of things, not least Acerbi. There are some green shoots as well. And I know that there have been struggles with Inter from a financial perspective in recent years. But actually, you look at the midfield and the way that they've built up a kind of backup three in there with Christian Aslani, with Davide Fratesi, and with Zielinski, who joined from Napoli. And you're thinking, okay, they maybe need a little bit more depth now, but there are pieces in there to start to, you know, work their way into the rotation and make those things happen. Now, they've also signed Petar Sucic, who's going to be a really interesting one, who comes in from Dinamo Zagreb. I think at that point, you're kind of looking at it and thinking, who is the man that's going to just see us through this period? And then we can start to rebuild it again, kind of more from a different perspective. And for me, I think that this feels like a risk, but also one which has a little bit more leeway. The fans are willing to give a little bit more time to someone like a Christian Kivu because of his association and his affiliation with the club. Now, that doesn't last forever. We know that. And Legends coming back in and getting the band back together. He's going to apparently appoint Walter Samwell as his second in command here, who I assume is just going to be his enforcer and stand behind him menacingly to make sure that players are listening. But I do think in terms of continuation and as the continuity candidate, he makes sense from an Inter perspective at this moment, especially once they were turned down by Como and Cesc Fabregas.
Yeah. Well, mate, that was a lot of detail. That was a proper lesson. I didn't know 80% of that. So you've properly filled in some gaps there.
Okay, let's flip over to the other side and a man you probably know a little bit more about in Max Allegri, who takes over.
I hope I'm more tuned into this one, yeah.
Well, this, I think, might be the most difficult job in football, as far as I'm concerned right now, because not only are you coming off a dreadful season where there was no European football for Milan and they're not going to be playing in any European competition next season, there were disappointments in pretty much every competition, bar the Supercoppa, which they won against Inter. The only games they seemed to be able to, you know, actually do anything last season were weirdly against Inter. So they sack Paolo Fonseca halfway through the season, Milan, and they replace him with Sergio Conceição, who wins the Supercoppa immediately and then proceeds to do very little else for his time at Milan. So they're going back to an old dog who knows the club well in Max Allegri. But it's not just this, Dean. It's the fact that Milan feel like they're losing almost everybody. Teo Hernandez today linked with a move away to Atletico Madrid. There is constant rumour that Rafa Leao is going to depart. Tijani Reinders has already joined Manchester City. Rumour today that Yunus Musa is going to be off to Napoli because Antonio Conte wants him and Musa wants to go because he wasn't part of the starting 11 as much as he kind of hoped last season. Then Mike Maignan linked with Chelsea. Now that deal's potentially fallen through, but his contract runs out in a year and it doesn't look like he's going to be signing a new one. So even if they keep him for this season, he probably won't be there next year. it just feels like everything is falling apart in many ways at Milan. And then there's loan players going back as well. So for Allegri to be coming in here, trying to attract players to a style of football that is at best difficult on the eye, I think is probably the way I would describe it. Trying to convince players to come in and join that system without European football is going to be very, very hard, even if you are a club as big and historic as Milan. And whilst I can understand the need for a safe pair of hands, it does feel a little bit like he has the most difficult and arduous task of any manager who's going to be appointed in Serie A.
Yeah, I mean, that's is that a hot take? I'm not sure. But it's certainly possible. There's obviously like nostalgia attached to it too, which isn't necessarily a good thing. I always fear in a moment like that. Milan obviously had a pretty much disastrous season in the end last year, which they've got to come back from. They never should have been out of the race as far as they were. And obviously at the moment, there's uncertainty around figures like Rafa Leão, who I'm not saying it's the worst thing in the world to move on from Leão. I don't actually think it would be I think it's brilliant when he wants to be. But he might have just like be ready to move on to something else. And I think that could change things for what they can do. Obviously, though, like you mentioned, they've already lost players in this window. So what's the aim here? All you can really do is like, you're not going to be winning the Scudetto, right? So that's beyond reach at the moment. So you're kind of looking at like, right, we want Champions League football back. Like we liked being back in that scene. Like let's get back in there. But it's so competitive to get back in that mix that's easier said than done. Obviously, like you would expect him to be able to get them at least on the cusp of that top four. But actually getting in there is difficult. And it'll be interesting to see what kind of approach he takes to actually doing that. Is it just a pragmatic approach, or is he willing to kind of take a risk here? At his stage of his career, I'm not really sure that that's going to be the case.
Yeah, me neither. I think this is a really difficult task. Now, Milan will become harder to beat, which is good from their perspective. Are they going to be fun to watch? I don't think so.
And that's what annoys me. Like, I want Milan to be fun. Like, last season, I went into last season, like, really excited about Milan.
Yeah,
and that was a fun place to be. But obviously, it flopped. It didn't work out. And, like, it was dreadful.
I can understand why they've done it. I just don't really like it.
Yeah,
I think it's probably
exactly. Yeah.
I mean, let's leave that one because I think it's going to be very interesting to see who Milan bring in. Like Luka Modric, it looks like he's going to join. Is a 39-year-old Luka Modric the answer to all Milan's prayers? No. Am I pleased for him? And do I think it's fun that he's going to potentially, you know, come to the sunset of his career in the Rossoneri? Yeah, I like it from a kind of emotional and narrative perspective. I don't hugely like it in terms of, is this the answer to Milan's problems perspective? But he'll at least add some leadership to that dressing room, which looked like it sorely lacked it last season. Let's come over to Roma, who have appointed Giampiero Gasperini. This is fun, right? And who's ready to have some numbers juiced? Who's ready? Artem Dovbik, do you want to score 30 goals next season because you're into it? Are we going to see 25 assists from Matias Sula? Yep. Here we go, ladies and gentlemen. Paulo Dybala about to rock up 30 goals and assists combined in all competitions. Mm-hmm. We're about to see some fun, I think, from this Roma side. Now, it's not the easiest thing in the world to transition Gasperini football from one place to another. And it is worth considering that he hasn't been a success everywhere that he's gone. But the man known as the Grand Chess Master has a new challenge on his hands. And from a kind of emotional perspective, I absolutely love this. I think this is going to be so much fun. Yeah. And I'm just really, really excited to see what this team looks like under Gasperini. Now, they have their own problems to deal with in terms of players currently not at the club, the amount of players that were loaned out last season that, you know, did different jobs at different places and how that's all going to shake out. But in terms of if you are the attacking core of this Roma side, you're looking at this and you are rubbing your hands together. You are thinking, here comes my moment. I've never had a golden boot before. This is my moment. I mean, Dovbik obviously has in La Liga, but you know, some other players are looking at this going, yep. Elder Shomurodov, who's just led Uzbekistan back to their first ever World Cup, is like, I'm about to score 25 goals in Serie A. This is going to be a fun year, isn't it? So, I mean, look, it's very exciting. And again, there's a lot of work to be done with this Roma squad. But I think that in terms of if you had anyone to appoint to follow Claudio Ranieri, who was obviously absolutely adored by this Roma fan base, who dug them out last season and got them into such a good rhythm, if Gasperini can take that, harness it and move on, I think everyone's in a really good place at Roma.
Oh, mate. Yeah, absolutely. Like, this is what you want. Like, this is what Milan needed, right? That's someone that's just going to let them roam. But Milan didn't trust anybody to go and do that. I don't know if it'll work. I don't
know if it's going to work either, but I think it's going to be fun.
It's definitely risky, and it could be be honest, I think it could be a disaster, but it could also be great. So football's supposed to be fun. And so from a neutral's perspective, embrace it, watch it, see what happens. From a fan perspective, hope for the best. Again, embrace it, but be prepared for the fact that it could implode. But yeah, like, I just want to see enjoying football again. Like, I keep talking about the fact that football needs to be becoming a bit more chaotic. It needs to be less predictable. And this is how we're going to get there. More appointments like this, please.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the flip side of this is it means that Atalanta have lost their most successful coach in their history, right? And they have replaced him with Ivan Juric, who was last seen at Southampton as they were relegated with almost a record low points total. Before that, he was at Roma for a little while. Now, it wasn't completely his fault at Roma, I should probably add, that the fan base was still absolutely livid that they'd got rid of Daniele De Rossi, and he was pretty much hounded out of Rome alongside the CEO at the time and some other people involved with the club. There were mistakes made, should we say, although they were rectified pretty quickly by the Roma management and the freaking group when they appointed Ranieri. Either way, the one pro of this, if I could put it this way, is that Juric is a Gasperini disciple. He's worked under him before, and he is someone who has followed him around for a little while. He has said when he was appointed a Southampton manager that he wanted to employ a Gasperini style at Southampton. That didn't work, but then again,
it did work for the other teams.
It worked for everyone else. Yeah, the games were entertaining against Southampton at the very least. I don't have loads of positives apart from that. We're looking at a coach who has had some success in his career, notably, I thought, with Hellas Verona and Torino, and made them both into very solid mid-table teams at that point. And then, you know, they got back-to-back top half finishes, Verona, I think, when he was there. I think they finished 9th and 10th. And then he became the Torino manager when he departed, and they had three very solid seasons from a Torino perspective, but nothing that would set the world on fire. He did a solid mid-table job with both clubs. He's coming into an Atalanta side who really, aside from a slide in sort of January, February time, should have been competing for the Scudetto this season under Gasperini. And I just cannot see this being an appointment that takes them to anywhere near a new height. We're talking about a manager in Gasperini who was able to squeeze every drop out of his attacking core, who were able to find moments where nobody else could, who played some of the most entertaining football that we've seen in years. Juric has done none of this, none of it. And I worry for Atalanta that the end of this Gasperini era could result in them sliding back into mid-table obscurity. And I really don't want that to happen because they've been one of the great success stories of European football over the last decade. And it feels like this is an appointment where they could have made something, they could have done something bold. They could have gone for a Paladino kind of figure. They could have made that stick. And instead, they've gone to the kind of safety, if you will, of a manager who has done fine in Serie A, but has never really set the world on fire on the basis that it's kind of a continuity candidate. And whilst that's not always a bad thing, as I kind of pointed out with Kivu at Inter, I think for this Atalanta squad, it could be really bad. And I think that there is a chance now that with players seeing Gasperini heading off, they're like, I might head off too. This might be the end of what has been an incredibly golden era for this Atalanta side.
Yeah. Look, he didn't translate into English football.
Yeah, that doesn't make him a bad coach, for what it's worth. I don't think anybody would have saved this Southampton team. That's not the reason I'm underwhelmed by this, I'll be honest.
So I don't know what the feeling is about him in Italy. I mean, I've only seen what we felt about him in Southampton, and basically came across as angry slash a bit of a melon at times. Like he was just feeling confused. He seemed frustrated. It just never worked. And I don't think that will be the case so much in Italy. So I don't think that that matters. But, you know, Southampton players certainly weren't motivated by him and his method. So I just hope that there's something different culturally that works here that didn't work for him in the last job, because it definitely, like, the same thing just definitely ain't going to work. So on the fence for now, but only because I'm giving him the benefit of the doubt. If I was just judging on what I've actually seen, I'd be like, this is a terrible appointment. I don't understand why you've gone here.
I understand why they've gone here, right? Like he played under Gasperini. He was his assistant coach at Inter. He has already said, come out in the press and be like, Gasperini's given me the advice on how to carry on. But you also kind of got to be your own man a little bit, right?
Yeah, well, Ferguson did that to David Moyes. He gave him advice on what to do.
I've spoken to a number of people around Italian football in the last couple of days on Sirius. We talked to a couple of Gazzetta journalists. I've spoken to Charlie Stelletano, etc. Nobody I've spoken to is anywhere near convinced that this is the right opportunity. Wow. Now, maybe he proves us all wrong. And again, I don't think he's a bad manager. I just think that this was an opportunity to do something exciting and explosive. And Atalanta have picked the safe option. And I'm not sure the safe option works when you're a club potentially punching above what has been naturally considered your weight. So that's the concern I have with Juric at Atalanta. But we shall see.
Good luck.
Ivan Juric, good luck indeed. Right, so I think that's probably all we've got time for on today's Ranks FC. So all that's left for me to do is say thank you very much to Mr. Dean Jones.
Cheers, mate.
I've been Jack Collins. This has been your favourite transatlantic football podcast, talking about some of the new managerial appointments across European football. We'll continue to keep you up to date across the course of this summer. But for now, thank you so much for listening. We'll see you all very shortly, Rank Squad. Take it easy.